Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Epilogue 1, Chapter 8. One matter connected with his management sometimes worried Nicholas, and that was his quick temper, together with his old hussar habit of making free use of his fists. At first he saw nothing reprehensible in this, but in the second year of his marriage his view of that form of punishment suddenly changed. Once, in summer, he had sent for the village elder from Bogachurivo, a man who had succeeded to the post where Dron died and who was accused of dishonesty and various irregularities. Nicholas went out into the porch to question him, and immediately after the elder had given a few replies, the sound of cries and blows was heard. On returning to lunch, Nicholas went up to his wife, who sat with her head bent low over her embroidery frame, and as usual began to tell her what he had been doing that morning. Among other things, he spoke of the Bogachurivo elder. Countess Mary turned red and then pale, but continued to sit with her head bowed and lips compressed, and gave her husband no reply. "Such an insolent scoundrel," he cried, growing hot again at the mere recollection of him. "If he had told me he was drunk and did not see... But what is the matter with you, Mary?" he suddenly asked. Countess Mary raised her head and tried to speak, but hastily looked down again, and her lips puckered. "Why, whatever is the matter, my dearest?" The looks of the plain Countess Mary always improved when she was in tears. She never cried from pain or vexation, but always from sorrow or pity, and when she wept her radiant eyes acquired an irresistible charm. The moment Nicholas took her hand, she could no longer restrain herself and began to cry. "Nicholas, I saw it, he was to blame, but why do you, Nicholas?" And she covered her face with her hands. Nicholas said nothing. He flushed crimson, left her side, and paced up and down the room. He understood what she was weeping about, but could not in his heart at once agree with her that what he had regarded from childhood as quite an everyday event was wrong. "Is it just sentimentality, old wives' tales, or is she right?" he asked himself. Before he had solved that point, he glanced again at her face, filled with love and pain, and he suddenly realized that she was right and that he had long been sinning against himself. "Mary," he said softly, going up to her, "it will never happen again, I give you my word, never," he repeated in a trembling voice like a boy asking for forgiveness. The tears flowed faster still from the Countess's eyes. She took his hand and kissed it. "Nicholas, when did you break your cameo?" she asked, to change the subject, looking at his finger on which he wore a ring with a cameo of Lacune's head. "Today it was the same affair. Oh, Mary, don't remind me of it." And again he flushed. "I give you my word of honour it shan't occur again, and let this always be a reminder to me," and he pointed to the broken ring. After that, when in discussions with his village elders or the stewards, the blood rushed to his face and his fists began to clench, Nicholas would turn the broken ring on his finger and would drop his eyes before the man who was making him angry. But he did not forget himself once or twice within a 12-month, and then he would go and confess to his wife and would again promise that this should really be the very last time. "Mary, you must despise me," he would say. "I deserve it. You should go. Go away at once. If you don't feel strong enough to control yourself," she would reply sadly, trying to comfort her husband. Among the gentry of the province, Nicholas was respected but not liked. He did not concern himself with the interests of his own class, and consequently, some thought him proud and others thought him stupid. The whole summer, from spring sowing to harvest, he was busy with the work on his farm. In autumn, he gave himself up to hunting with the same business-like seriousness, leaving home for a month, or even two, with his hunt. In winter, he visited his other villages or spent time reading. The books he read were chiefly historical, and on these he spent a certain sum every year. He was collecting, as he said, a serious library, and he made it a rule to read through all the books he bought. He would sit in his study with a grave air, reading, a task he first imposed upon himself as a duty, but which afterwards became a habit, affording him a special kind of pleasure and a consciousness of being occupied with serious matters. In winter, except for business excursions, he spent most of his time at home making himself one with his family and entering into all the details of his children's relations with their mother. The harmony between him and his wife grew closer and closer, and he daily discovered fresh spiritual treasures in her. From the time of his marriage, Sonia had lived in his house. Before that, Nicholas had told his wife all that had passed between himself and Sonia, blaming himself and commending her. He had asked Princess Mary to be gentle and kind to his cousin. She thoroughly realized the wrong he had done Sonia, felt herself to blame towards her, and imagined that her wealth had influenced Nicholas's choice. She could not find fault with Sonia in any way, and tried to be fond of her, but often felt ill will towards her, which she could not overcome. Once she had a talk with her friend Natasha about Sonia and about her own injustices towards her. "You know," said Natasha, "you have read the Gospels a great deal. There is a passage in them that just fits Sonia." "What?" asked Countess Mary, surprised. "To him that hath shall be given, and from him that hath not shall be taken away." "You remember? She is one that hath not. Why, I don't know. Perhaps she lacks egotism. I don't know. But from her is taken away, and everything has been taken away. Sometimes I am dreadfully sorry for her. Formerly I very much wanted Nicholas to marry her, but I always had a sort of presentiment that it would not come off. She is a sterile flower, you know, like some strawberry blossoms. Sometimes I am sorry for her, and sometimes I think she doesn't feel it as you or I would." Though Countess Mary told Natasha that these words in the Gospel must be understood differently, yet, looking at Sonia, she agreed with Natasha's explanation. It really seemed that Sonia did not feel her position trying, and had grown quite reconciled to her lot as a sterile flower. She seemed to be fond not so much of individuals as of the family as a whole. Like a cat, she had attached herself not to the people but to the home. She waited on the old countess, petted and spoiled the children, was always ready to render the small services for which she had a gift, and all this was unconsciously accepted from her with insufficient gratitude. The country seat at Bald Hills had been rebuilt, though not on the same scale as under the old prince. The buildings, begun under straitened circumstances, were more than simple. The immense house on the old stone foundations was of wood, plastered only inside. It had bare deal floors, and was furnished with very simple hard sofas, armchairs, tables, and chairs, made by their own serf carpenters out of their own birchwood. The house was spacious and had rooms for the house serfs and apartments for visitors. Whole families of Rostov's and Bolkonsky's relations sometimes came to Bald Hills with 16 horses and dozens of servants and stayed for months. Besides that, four times a year, on the name days and birthdays of the hosts, as many as 100 visitors would gather there for a day or two. The rest of the year, life pursued its unbroken routine with its ordinary occupations and its breakfasts, lunches, dinners, and suppers provided out of the produce of the estate. All right, there we go, another chapter done. quickly going to do an advertisement here. This podcast is brought to you by Audible, the audiobook legends. Audible have the most awesome collection of audiobooks in the world ever. And you can start listening to pretty much any audiobook you like for free with a free 1 month Audible trial. Audible is like this app you get on your phone and then you plug your headphones in. You dial in what book you want to listen to, and then boom, you're listening to it as an audiobook. It's pretty great. 1 month free trial, and you get to choose any one book from all of their catalogue. You get a free book, and you get a month to listen to it, and if you don't like it, you just cancel it. That's free. Free stuff. Of course, if you continue the subscription after the month, it starts charging you a monthly fee, which I think is around the $15 mark. I'm not exactly sure. But hey, 1 month free trial is a pretty awesome thing. Go to audibletrial.com/ander. All right, thank you for your patience there. Hey, what a chapter this was. First of all, Nikolai has just like skyrocketed into old man-ness. I'm just so used to thinking of him as this wide-eyed, young, teenage guy out there trying to prove himself in the world. Now he's like a grumpy old dude. What a change. He's just... It's pretty accurate though, right? Because people change, especially at around like the 30 mark. At 30, they just suddenly become like... occupied by responsibility. Like their mind is occupied by, ooh, I need to be responsible. And they just do this about face and change. And I feel like that's what Nikolai's done. And the catalyst is clearly the death of his brother and his father. I think his father more so. Just a great character. And I don't mean that as in to say he's likable, but the way he fell from grace is so relatable. Hopefully not of myself, but it just seems so human. I really liked him when he was young, idealistic teenager. And you see this trajectory where he's trying to prove himself a man, always as a young man. And then he finally sort of gets there. He gets married. He inherits a debt. He clears the debt. He starts working hard. And it all just sort of turns him into this little bit cruel, a little bit too harsh, grumpy guy who likes to sit in his library and read about history. He did redeem himself a little bit by seeing the error of his ways, right? And admitting it to his wife and changing and successfully changing. And he's changed a lifelong ingrained sort of reality, right? Because what he was doing, being cruel to the serfs, it mentioned that even from childhood, that just seemed like what people did. So he didn't see himself as doing something particularly cruel. He just saw himself as doing the thing people do. But he had what did he have? I was going to say like strength of character, but I'm not even sure if that might be a bit too generous. But he was able to accept the reprimand from Mary and change. So, little redeeming quality there. But just a very well-written character, because you've seen him fall from grace. You've seen him become an asshole. But I don't like him, but I still respect his character. In terms of likability, he's dropped down quite a few rungs of the ladder there, but I'll tell you who's shot up that ladder to maybe my second or third favourite character in the book would be Sonya. And I just feel so bad for her. This chapter especially just was just gut-wrenching. Like the way Natasha and Maya, her closest people, Natasha especially, like they've been friends since childhood. Natasha goes and says something like she just doesn't think Sonya feels things the same way as us haves do. She's a have-not, and she's just that is that way. And us privileged people, I just don't think she feels pain the same way we do. And to have your lifelong closest friend just regard you in that way, God, what a summary of poor Sonia's life. Natasha inadvertently, her analogy was quite accurate, but then in a meta sort of way, her attitude completely validated the analogy, but I don't think she meant for that to happen. Like, just that little comment of, I don't think she feels things the way we do, just, oh, what a moment. Really, really powerful writing, and unpleasant. And lastly, the thing I noticed in this chapter was I didn't notice until I watched the BBC miniseries, which I would very highly recommend. I haven't watched the final episode yet, but I'm looking forward to watching it once I finish the book, because I know that the final episode is the end of the book. So the miniseries covers the whole book. But the first, I think, 7 episodes or however many that it is, they're absolutely brilliant. The thing that they did the best was give me the sense of scale and a sense of grandeur in these people's lives. Because I knew they were rich, and I knew that they were the top of the society. But it's their houses are mansions. Their houses are beyond mansions. They're like, you know, when you go to like a museum in a big city, and that museum is like a huge, huge building. That's what their houses were like. It's crazy. And that's one of their houses. And so the miniseries really just gave you an idea of that. Like when they're in their, like, you know, their family room or something, and they're having a soiree, it's like they're in a ballroom, what looks like a ballroom. And that's just one of the rooms of their house. Another picture that gave me a sense of that scale is there was a picture posted on the subreddit, and it was like a view of the sky from where Tolstoy lived. And Tolstoy was one of these privileged people as well. And it's looking up from what looks like a courtyard, and all around it is like apartments. And I'm like, oh, okay, he lived in one of those apartments up in that massive building. It's like, no, that's his house. That's not an apartment building. That's his house. That whole building. Like, oh, wow, it just spins your head out. So I'm actually looking at this picture like, oh, those look like actually quite nice apartments. Yeah, I can see why he was a privileged person to live in one of those. It's like, no, that's his house. Jesus. And this chapter really helped illustrate that as well. This illustration of the grandeur should have been way earlier in the book, and maybe it just went over my head, but the way they described how they fixed Bald Hills, and it wasn't as grandiose as it was before, and, you know, they just made it out of wood this time, and there was a little bit of plaster, and the furniture was just made out of their own wood that they had their serfs just mock up, you know, a couple of chairs, couches, you know, an entire mansion's worth of furniture, nothing special, right? And they're talking about how understated, and it's just a little mansion. And, you know, just the kind of place that maybe once a year, you and 100 of your friends can stay there for a few nights. 100. Oh, I was like, what? Stop trying to understate a mansion that can comfortably accommodate over 100 people. It's insanity. Anyway, so that little detail at the end of this chapter really helped to illustrate just how insanely privileged these people were. I was comparing their life, when I was watching the miniseries, I was like, oh, they can just go out of their house, jump into the back of like one of these really plush looking caravan things, like a horse and cart sort of thing, carriage, and then a horse driver just takes them somewhere, and they just sit in the back in this really luxury thing. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of like Uber. It's like they had Uber back then. And I was like, wait a minute, this is way better than Uber, because they're sitting in like a luxury caravan. being chauffeured, and that this chauffeur and caravan and horses are just like waiting on site, just hanging out. Anyway, so that was 200 years ago, and they were, yeah, they had Uber beat by a country mile. Anyway, okay, that's my rambling about the privilegedness. Watch the BBC miniseries, even just the first episode, and you just get an idea of like the setting of this book, because that's one thing that Tolstoy didn't do a good job of, I don't think, is setting, is giving that feeling to the reader that they're really there, because I was not picturing the settings right at all, and it was only once I started watching the BBC series, and I was like, oh, that's what this place looks like, okay, and their costumes too, like, they're brilliant. My first thought was like, oh, this is like those jackets like Coldplay and stuff were wearing, right? But then you're like, oh, no, wait a minute. The jackets that Coldplay are wearing are like costumes, like cheap imitations. Like these clothings that they're wearing are ridiculously luxurious. Anyway, I think you get the picture there. Turtle Vader asked, what do you think of Tolstoy's reproachful depiction of Nikolai's violence towards his headman? It seemed a weird little detail, didn't it? That Nicholas just became violent for half a chapter and then saw the error of his ways and that was it. It seemed like Tolstoy had added a little detail of maybe something he experienced himself with a family member or a friend or maybe even himself. De Fleury said Nicholas reads like my cousin, eating breakfast cereal made from spelt, not from love, but as a duty, and because it makes him feel smart. That's what kind of man he is, and I hate him. Nicholas, not the spelt eater, who at least has enough self-awareness to joke about it. Hate's a strong word. I wonder, De Fleury, have you always hated him? Or is it just this last few turns of event since his father's death? Oh, what's the story? Because the man's changed quite a lot. I always thought his heart was in the right place, but now I think he's gone a little bit off the rails, a little bit haywire. Turtle Vader said he would sit in his study with an important look, reading his look over this reading, which was first self-imposed as a duty, but later became a habitual occupation that provided him with a special sort of pleasure and the awareness of being occupied with a serious matter. Does anyone else feel like this describes our last year of reading? It certainly struck a chord with me. Yeah, it struck a chord for me as well. Turtle Vader. Not so much with this project, but going back, I'd say like 10 or 15 years in my own life, I've always been a big reader, but it was around the sort of time when I decided I wanted to do a bit of writing, get into writing, and then I would start to read in two different ways. Category A was reading for fun, which I did a lot. I did quite a lot. That was reading for entertainment, reading because I actually was sucked into the story. And then category B was like the challenge reading, where you're reading something that's beyond you, and you're constantly having to like reread sentences or wrap your head around it, look things up, or research things, dive deeper into it, and it was a bit more strenuous, it wasn't as rewarding, it was more rewarding, I should say, but it wasn't as, like, entertaining. It was a chore, almost, but I did it, it was like practicing a musical instrument, or refining a skill, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I did it in that same manner that Tolstoy describes here. It does eventually become a habit, and you do get that special sort of pleasure, the pleasure and the awareness of being occupied with a serious matter. That was Category B reading, and I wasn't always up for Category B reading. You know, like when it's the end of a big day and you're tired and you just want to unwind, that's not when I'm up for this challenge type reading. It was more like, give me one of those popcorn books where it's just entertaining and easy. So yeah, that was the chord that was struck with me. I think this book would definitely be a challenge read for me if I didn't have this community to help me reflect and to lend all these insights about what's going on. It's kind of taken away that need to go off and research and look things up, so thank you guys. Turtle Vader said, what are your thoughts on Sonya living in their house, given her history with Nikolai? Do you think Maya's wicked feelings are at all justified? Oh, God. Yeah, Maya's wicked feelings are understandable. You know, what you wouldn't... So she doesn't want her to go. She doesn't not want her there, but why would she want her there, sort of thing, you know? It's almost like Maya herself wishes something better for Sonya. And yeah, her living in the house, it's like, well, it's the place for her, right? That's the Rostov household now, and that's where she's always been. But again, yeah, there's got to be something better for Sonya. I feel so bad for her. That's just her lot in life. And it's, the most heartbreaking thing, like I said before, was learning that those closest to her that she loves so much look at her and think she doesn't feel the injustice of this as much as we do. She doesn't feel pain like we do. What an awful thing. But what's for her? I just hope that... You know what I hope is that Nikolai might one day just give her her own lot and say, look, this is yours now. Just a small little house on some land where that she can call her own or something like that. Just... Yeah, that's probably wishful thinking. Probably never going to happen, but that's what I would wish for her. Very cool. All right, so I'm just doing the math here, and I think we've got about 20 or so episodes to go, which would mean I think we're going to end this book on around the 2nd or 3rd or maybe even the 4th of January. It's just the way it's all timed out. So the whole, like, ending on the new year sort of thing... didn't quite go as planned. It is because I started a few days later than the A Year of War and Peace subreddit. So that's what to expect. Don't think it's going to be like, Happy New Year, we finished the book. It's going to be, the timing's going to be just a little bit off. But hey, you know what's cool is we get to celebrate Christmas together. We get to celebrate New Year's together. And then we get to celebrate a third thing, finishing the book together. So it's just going to be like a whole like week straight of celebrating. So another, we get an extra date on which to be happy. So hey, that's my positive spin on it. And then we're going to dive into, what was the first one? I should know this, shouldn't I? It was one of the Stephen Crane ones. The Blue Hotel, I think, was the first one we're going to do. The Blue Hotel. Oh, you know what I've just noticed? On the air, live on the air. Because I'm like, why is this looking backwards to me? For some reason, I've done this in reverse. So in the interior of the paperback book, there is introduction, page 1, the open boat, page 5, and the Blue Hotel, page 61. So the first book, the first story in the book is the open boat, and then the Blue Hotel. But I've called the book... The Blue Hotel and the Open Boat. So I've switched the order on the front cover. But then the title of the book on the Amazon thing is the other way around. So if you look on the page, it says The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel. Paperback, The Hemingway List. And then on the little cover art picture, you can see I've flipped that around. That is a silly mistake. I mean, I suppose it doesn't really make any difference. It's just the way it's written on the front cover, but I might have to go and fix that. I might have to go and rearrange the cover art there. I think some people have already bought this, so if you have, you are going to have a rare a rare copy where the cover art says the wrong thing. How's that, hey? Just in case it wasn't all confusing enough already. Well, I'll go and correct that at some point in the next day or so. Anyway, the books are there. Please do go and have a look at them. Or sort out your copies of the books for next year, you're going to need The Open Boat by Stephen Crane, The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane, and Dubliners by James Joyce. Those are the next three books that you're going to need. You can find them all for free online very easily. Just do a bit of Googling. And you can also find them in bookshops, used bookshops. They're not hard to come by. Very popular books, especially Dubliners is really easy to find. Or, of course, you can buy the official The Hemingway List versions by going to thehemingwaylist.com. Okay, thank you all very much for listening today. I will see you tomorrow.